And welcome once again to EW10's Bookmark. I'm Doug Keck, your host. Our guest author is John D. Finley, PhD, co-author and editor of Sexual Identity, The Harmony of Philosophy, Science, and Revelation. And it's naturally available through the EWTN Religious Catalog, EWTNRC.com, for all things Catholic. Welcome, Doctor, to EWTN's Bookmark.
Very
nice to have you on here for the first time. People might recognize you from being on with Father Mitch and also on Life on the Rock. So we really put you through the grinder while you were here visiting us, huh?
It's great to be here.
Okay, great. So where are you teaching now?
I'm at Thomas Aquinas College in California.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, where would the idea of putting this book together, and why did you think it was important to do at this time?
Well, partly a place, an institution like Thomas Aquinas, which is interdisciplinary and values the contributions.
What does that mean?
Well, so that you're studying the traditions of mathematics, science, as well as philosophy, literature, and theology. Mm-hmm. So I had a personal philosophical interest in the nature of man and woman, especially coming out of the thought of Thomas Aquinas. Mm-hmm. But I realized as I was researching the question as to what makes us male and female, that we need an engagement with the sciences to be able to think more deeply about this. So for example, Genesis, he created them male and female, but then you have someone with a difficult chromosomal condition where it might be ambiguous as to what they in fact are when it comes to their sexuality. Does that pose a contradiction to scripture or not? Well, let's look a little more deeply into the genetics and the biology of what's going on. So I figured it would be really important, especially given the challenging issues with the homosexual movement and the transgender movement today, to put together a group of people from these different fields, from biology, the study of hormones, endocrinology, psychology, philosophy, and theology, and we would try and pose the question, what is a man, what is a woman, from the standpoint of all these different fields.
Right, and your approach, though there's underlying Catholicism and Christianity in it, you're really trying to take it on initially from the scientific perspective, right?
Science and philosophy are our unaided human reason, what we're able to know. So ultimately, it is a Catholic work. We've got the theology as the capstone of it all. But yes, about 80% of this book could be read by someone who has no affiliation with Christianity and should be able to appreciate the scientific and philosophical and psychological contributions.
At the beginning of the book, you said, despite living amidst a worldwide web of information, we've lost sight of ourselves. What does that mean?
Well, partly because of the fact that we're bombarded with information, mere facts, and from a host of varying viewpoints, it's very difficult for us to be able to self-reflect. And I don't pin something like the confusion surrounding gender simply on technology, but there's no question that the prevalence of social media and the addictiveness of that media has exacerbated the problem. But more deeply, we've lost our moorings as a result of a disconnection from the truth.
Right. You talk about in the beginning about referencing, I think it was Women's March, and some people were interviewed with, you know, answers like, I couldn't tell you what a woman is, or a woman is whatever they feel like. And you said, heaven forbid we ask what a man is, and because masculine toxicity seemed to go together like they were always one word. There's a hyphen in there. And do you think sometimes some of the stuff we're dealing with, especially since it seems to be you're dealing with a lot of young women dealing with kind of the transgender thing going on in their lives as well, that it's because the sexes have been kind of put in opposition with each other between a feminist movement and kind of this masculine toxicity?
I think that is a symptom of what we're seeing. And it's one of these many overblown or exaggerated stereotypes that's infected much of our first world society for the past several decades. So, for example, the fact that you do have hypersexualized and in that way idealized images of women that have dominated our culture and of men also on the other side through the media's imagery for so long in films and advertisements, you could see how that could lead to a reaction on the part of many people to try and dissociate themselves from that sort of, again, hypersexualized idealization of what it is to be man or woman. But the problem is that you kind of throw out the baby with the bathwater as well.
Right. You make the point that those kind of comments are part of a larger cultural movement, but are no longer outliers, but vivid markers of an incoherence in our society.
Yeah. So this is a huge issue that, and John Paul II spells this out really nicely in his encyclical Fides et Ratio, that when he goes back to Genesis, to the story of the fall, and sees that there's a fundamental failure in the fall on the part of human reason, as well as, of course, this disjunct between the man and the woman that take place. Mm-hmm. So it shouldn't surprise us that problems linked with sexuality, with the man-woman relationship, should be accompanied by a kind of failure in rationality. And that's this incoherence that I'm talking about has to do with the fact that, on the one hand, culture, many quarters of the culture, would advocate that women, for example, be subjected to biological males on their sports teams. Mm-hmm. But then, on the other side, there's this championing of women's rights that is a salutary thing, but reached a kind of excess through a radical feminist movement.
Right, right.
And so how do you hold those two things together? And some people who wouldn't even be typically within the Catholic world viewpoint have noticed that,
right,
and have pointed out the logical contradictions.
Well, you say, and you're talking about Plato and Socrates, and here you say, rarely has the character and fall of human rationality been brought to the fore as in the 21st century first world.
Yeah, so when's the last time in human history that these fundamental metaphysical questions mm-hmm. became the stuff of society's headlines? Mm-hmm. What is a man? What is a woman? What does it mean to be human in that way? These are philosophical questions, and they typically aren't the kind of thing that news channels are caught up with. And so the fact that we're at that point, that we're unable as a society to answer these questions, that a Supreme Court justice
right.
is unable, it doesn't even wish to face the question, is a remarkable thing.
Right. You say the fact that we are asking this question or these questions as a society is an ambiguous sign. Goes on to say, for vagueness is not just a different path from truthful speech leading to a destination embraced on its own terms. You go on to say, being untruthful is not just a way of failing at being human, it is the way.
Yeah, that's right. So what we are, as created in the image and likeness of God, is an animal, right? A fleshly being, but that's endowed with reason and free will. Mm-hmm. And so for us to fail rationally in our deliberate thoughtfulness is in some real way the fundamental human failing.
You say incoherence leads to isolation and intellectual slavery. How does that work?
Yeah, so when you see the kinds of contradictions that we've alluded to within our society, the fact that we're unable to express the truth regarding ourselves, and the fact that we find ourselves forced often to say what we know to be false, mm-hmm. then we're no longer able to pursue with others the common good that truth is.
Mm-hmm. Well, the issue is agreeing on that, right? So, as you say, nothing public or common can be asserted as true. You say it is not just what transgender ideology makes us unable to speak coherently about man and woman, it also leaves trans persons as ghosts of themselves, crippled in their bodily capacities for relations with others. You go on to say, at the same time, though, what does our sexual difference mean anyway? We barely need it for reproduction, so the question is, what's the big deal?
Yeah, so that's the other side of why I was motivated to pursue this project, is because you do have some of these hot-button issues like the transgender movement, but you also have technological advances that allow, or soon will allow, for human reproduction without couples engaging in sexual intercourse, various forms of surrogacy, perhaps artificial wombs. Mm-hmm. And so in a lot of people's minds, there really is this question, well, what's the whole point of male and female to begin with? It's all fluid. It can all be changed by
right.
our science and technology.
Right, right. So it's just you religious Catholic guys who are a little hung up on
yeah.
the Bible and other stuff like that. Now, you mentioned in here the idea of this book being a response to what's going on in the culture. You mentioned Harry Became Sally, that book, Reversible Damage, a lot of the stuff that's going on. We read about in the headlines, happily Father Spitzer and I get to talk about it on his show. But you say this book takes two different routes, but prioritizes the second. It asks the question, what is a man and a woman, and seeks to offer something of human and divine wisdom in response. You say that this book is interdisciplinary and holistic. Explain what that means.
Yeah, so what I meant is that along the way, the book offers truths that are in fact proper responses to some of the challenges that we see today. But the primary thrust of the book is not polemical, but mm-hmm. rather truth-seeking. Mm-hmm. Because that's ultimately, truth is more interesting than falsehood. Mm-hmm. And so it's important to be able to combat falsehood, but it's even more important to pursue truth. Mm-hmm. And again, I thought that in the case of this issue, it was really crucial to approach the question from an interdisciplinary standpoint, to approach what it means to be man and woman from the standpoint of biology,
right.
psychology, philosophy.
Well, do you think part of the problem we're having in society is we're bifurcating and separating these things out? We're not connecting it across the board. We just take some situation in isolation and twist it to achieve our goal.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that's that again, John Paul II laments in Vitae et Ratio, is the branches of knowledge have become fragmented, mm-hmm. dissociated from each other, and that's a big part of the importance of philosophy. Is that philosophy is what's able to take a look at the whole and properly see the scientific contributions for what they are, both in their positive grasp of the truth, but also in their limitations. Mm-hmm. Because if you had to say that there's a single voice of rational authority in our culture today, it would be science.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not how it should be.
Yeah, or scientism.
Scientism is the name for it.
What we're really dealing with. You also talk about the fact that this book is somewhat unique, and you mentioned in the beginning there are six authors. The authors are recognized experts, and you spent actually several years putting this together. How did you identify those people, and then how did you work on the book?
Yeah, it's a wonderful people. I knew I needed people who were experts in these different fields, but who were also Catholic, and who had some appreciation mm-hmm. for philosophy and theology. And so Dr. Kara Buskmiller is a fetal maternal specialist.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Paul Ruse, a pediatric endocrinologist. Dr. Patrick Lappert, a plastic surgeon. Dr. Andrew Sodergren, a psychologist. And Dr. Lawrence Welch, a theologian. And I was lucky, I was in St. Louis at the time, and a number of these people were local. It was very providential to run into them. And in the case of Dr. Sodergren, I recall literally Googling Catholic psychologist interested in philosophy, mm-hmm. and somehow he came up.
Yeah. See, there are good things from Google, right?
That's right.
Now, you say we begin with philosophy, so do you have Sartre and Foucault and other people like that in here? Are those the people you focus on?
No, we didn't quite make it. You know, there's a page count.
We're not into postmodernism.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So with the philosophical approach, I thought at first that I was going to just start with biology,
mm-hmm.
start with what many would consider the fundamental facts. But then I realized, actually, science can't be first because science is so specialized. What needs to be first is a kind of everyman's philosophical take on things. So you might imagine a Peter Kreeft or C.S. Lewis, that type of philosophical mm-hmm. take on the reality, on the question what it is to be man or woman. And so that's the opening chapter, and then we move into the science.
Yeah, and chapter 3 focuses on sexual difference from a psychological point of view, considering the ways in which men and women perceive, think, and respond, behave. Now, you say, yet the argument we cannot ignore is the current objection, even if men and women are typically, as you say, science and technology have changed everything, people go in for sex changes, a guy can become a very attractive girl. And of course, I'm assuming that's one of the reasons why you had in the book somebody who was actually doing plastic surgery and
that's
was
right.
familiar with what gets done. Because again, you can create the illusion, but not the reality.
Exactly. And that's that chapter is in some way the most fascinating, but also the most difficult to read, because it goes into some of the more graphic details regarding what these surgical attempts look like,
mm-hmm.
and the ways in which they're so clearly forced and artificial and do great violence to the person.
Right. So the chapters form a unity from the everyday to the eternal, and you go on to say our style is deliberately not academic. How do you achieve that goal?
It's difficult, especially since all of us our PhDs, so, our academics, we're used to doing our research and talking to about five other people in the world.
Right.
That's why we needed to spend a lot of time meeting with each other, reading each other's works, learning each other's languages, and also constantly reminding ourselves that we have to address a broader audience.
Mm-hmm.
So trying to remain substantive, but also in an accessible voice.
Right.
It's not easy.
Right now, and since you are dealing with interesting topics and deep topics, you actually have set it up so you have like a conclusion in each chapter sort of, and then review points.
That's right. I thought it was important to have a series of review points at the end of each chapter. And I would imagine that it'd be the case with this kind of book that it'll be rare for someone perhaps to read it mm-hmm. cover to cover, but someone who's less familiar with the sciences might flip to the biological chapter.
Right.
Or to the psychological chapter. And conversely, someone who's less familiar with philosophy might flip to a philosophical chapter in order to see what...
Or do what a lot of people do these days. They go and look at the answers in the back of the book, and then they go, oh, okay, this sounds interesting. Let me figure out how you got to that answer.
Sure.
Sort of something like that. You do say, and this, without man and woman, the human race does not exist. Without the capacity for truth, we are not human. Philosophical position?
Well, absolutely. So... our relationship with truth involves interpersonal dimensions, right? We learn from others. From the time we're little kids, we would never come to learn anything were it not for our parents, our loved ones, and those around us. So again, there's a deep connection between our pursuit and engagement with truth and our lives as social beings. And of course, it's the man-woman relation is the paradigmatic form of our being social.
Why do you think that changed so much and kind of the androgynous kind of approach? Is that kind of like a science fiction kind of futuristic view of society, Brave New World and stuff like that?
It's an interesting question. It would make sense to me to think that as we approach a state where many people are thinking that the human consciousness will be uploaded into AI, so to speak, or where AI itself will become somehow aware,
right,
self-conscious,
right,
that our bodiliness, the bodily side of what it is to be human, will simply become extraneous and accidental.
Mm-hmm.
And so then maybe it's been that way all along,
mm-hmm.
is the sort of the message
you would
hear.
We've evolved to understand it better.
Right.
Right. So this progressive approach to, we're getting better every day. You say near the end in your section here, in particular, sexual identity is essential to the male and female self. Culture is the natural arena in which such identification occurs.
Yeah, so I thought it was very important to talk about self-expression and self-identity because this is a banner under which much of the transgender movement has organized itself, right? Is that, well, I feel this way about myself. I'm conscious of myself this way, so I need to express it, and others need to validate me in that self-expression. Mm-hmm. And so the point I was trying to make is that it's true that self-awareness and self-expression is absolutely central to being human, right? That's part of what it is to be rational. But that self-awareness is predicated on, it piggybacks on what we are truly in the
mm-hmm.
first place,
mm-hmm.
right? And so if I'm Irish, by heritage, well then, as properly human, I'm self-aware of myself as Irish, right? And the same is true of being man or woman. We can't divorce what we actually are from our self-awareness of that fact.
Yeah, you also talk about it here. Intersex conditions do not present alternative sexes since they are partial or deficient manifestations of male or female sexuality to begin with. I mean, I don't know how many times you get the people with the hermaphrodite stories or some other thing as the justification, you know, the exception that proves that somehow it's okay.
Yeah, so this was something, even in my philosophical writings, I realized, well, this is an interesting question. What do we do with some of these cases of what's called true hermaphroditism, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where there's even at the chromosomal level, there's ambiguity. And of course, this is a very challenging condition for a person dealing with that situation. But you can see that kind of condition, even if we're unable to determine whether the person is male or female, that condition involves precisely a loss of something.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Some sort of infertility, a lack of a fundamental human ability, which means that it doesn't count as just a third way of being.
Right.
It's a problem. It's a deficiency.
Or I was born in the wrong body kind of approach, which shows up in here with that idea. This was also interesting, too. The notion of gender as truly separate from biological sex is incoherent. You say, now I remember growing up in the 60s and the nuns teaching us about gender. It had something to do with English and how we did language.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden it showed up in sociology or whatever.
Right. So it achieved prominence, interestingly, when the word sex in English became primarily used just to refer to intercourse. Mm-hmm. Then gender started taking off as a word that had to do with cultural and social expression, merely, as though that could be divorced from the biological reality. And one of the points I try to make about culture is that we see in the realm of human sexuality the natural bridge between the individual person, the self, and the person as social, right? So intercourse, pregnancy, family, these are all realities that are both biological but also cultural and social. Mm-hmm. And we've got to retain our awareness of that. Otherwise, we're going to be forced into this notion where we think there's just us, the individuals, and then these artificial constructs that make up society and culture. Mm-hmm. And that's what a lot of people have bought into.
In the chapter, moving ahead into biology, from a merely biological perspective, it's not possible to change one's sex.
That's right.
But people think it is.
And this is something where, again, it's so important to just know some of the basic biological facts, which even many well-intentioned Christians don't know. So, for example, the fact that the XX or XY, the female or male genetic pattern, is found in every cell of your body, that's an amazing reality, right? So in order to actually change one's sex, you would have to change a person's entire bodiliness.
Right, I don't think, and that's why you say sex is determined at the moment of conception and cannot be changed, because you hear this idea that, well, they're assigning, male or female at birth, and they shouldn't be doing that. But the biology is signing.
Exactly, the biology is there.
Right, right.
And sexuality is a very important point. It's an aspect of our being that runs through the whole of what we are. So again, it characterizes every cell in our body. It characterizes behavior, and that's what the psychology chapter is about. It characterizes our vocation, our fatherhood, our motherhood, whether that be biological or adoptive or by way of mentorship, mm-hmm. and it characterizes the way in which we image God.
Right. In the psychology of the sexual difference mentioned, that studies in newborns and adults indicate that females typically show greater interest in people while males show greater interest in things. Oh, there is a difference. It is complementary.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, there's an astounding number of interesting differences that come up in that chapter, one of which I recall is a study that was done that showed that not only human young males, but also primate young males are more interested in machinery, mm-hmm. whereas both human and primate young females are more interested in others of their kind.
Relational and
right?
empathy,
yeah.
and you see those things. Studies of early onset cases of gender dysphoria show many problems with parental attachment and family dynamics. For years, people saw these things as psychological issues that could be treated, and I know at least the numbers, 80% of people who feel this way naturally grow out of it.
That's
by
right.
the time they hit puberty or into their late teens, right?
That's right, and this is why in some ways the psychological chapter is so central, is because this is the realm that we're really dealing with when it comes to a transgender identification. We've got to look at the person's own history and what it is they've been experiencing and try and help them from that standpoint.
In general, the male brain appears somewhat biased towards systematizing things, and the female brain appears somewhat biased toward emphasizing empathy. And this I thought was interesting. Men and women seem to differ in their inclination towards various dimensions of religion. I'm assuming that's why you see the men smoking cigarettes outside the church and the women are in the church a lot of times.
At least
in the old days.
Right. Yeah, there, I think one of the phenomena that Dr. Sodergren alludes to there is that the God as just is typically a way in which males will incline. God as merciful, as compassionate, is often a way in which the females will tend to think. Now, again, these are generalizations.
But that's all you can do.
Indicative.
I mean, we live in a world where if you make a generalization, somebody will find the one exception And it's like, well, that doesn't mean the generalization isn't actually true.
Exactly.
Okay. Most children who identify as cross-sex will naturally grow out of it. What is affirmed in gender affirming surgery is a subjective feeling or belief without correspondence to any biological reality. And usually that positive nature of that change wears off quickly.
Yeah, so I don't know if you've seen, probably many people listening have seen the documentary, What is a Woman?
Mm-hmm.
And I started writing this
just
before that documentary was made. But it's such an excellent show because it reveals the extraordinary minimal attention that's given by a medical staff before admitting a person to some of these surgeries. It's simply predicated on what the self-awareness, the self-expression is feeling.
Right, and are men and women interchangeable? In no other area of medicine does the patient make a diagnosis that leads to irreversible medical procedures resulting in loss of human capacity, exactly what you're saying.
Right.
If I feel this way and I kind of want this thing and that's what you want, okay, we're ready to go. And so the question is how much of that is cultural conditioning in a sense of kind of wanting to be woke, and how much of that is financial? Because the question with these things many times is, are there financial considerations to these very expensive surgeries? There was a quote from a particular university which was caught on tape, where a professor was talking about how if they moved into doing these things, it was financially beneficial for the university.
Absolutely. And we're already starting to see some of the fallout mm-hmm. of that approach, where there are lawsuits from people who are trying to detransition, trying to regain their original actual biological sex, and realizing that what's happened to them is a gross manipulation of power on the part of the medical industry.
Right. Are you surprised that we seem to that we're still taking the lead on this as Europe kind of backs away?
That's very interesting. There are ways in which, while Europe explicitly is more secularized than the United States, there are other ways in which Europe has many countries in Europe have a deeper cultural appreciation for what the human reality is.
Okay.
And ours is so driven by media, and we've affected much of the rest of the world in that way.
We're just out of time. Another book in the works?
Possibly, though this one will be a bit more philosophical,
okay,
a little more academic.
Very good.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, John D. Finley, PhD, co-author and editor of Sexual Identity, The Harmony of Philosophy, Science, and Revelation. And we do need it, especially as Catholics today. Check this book out through E.W. Tin's religious catalog, EWTNRC.com, for all things Catholic. I'm Doug Keck. Thanks for joining us right here on Bookmark. We'll see you next time.